apparently deep in thought. Valerie sat down too. Her eyes got heavier and heavier. She glanced at the captain. Whatever he was thinking, the man was absorbed with it. Could she lie down for just a bit? The minutes ticked by in silence. Finally, Valerie rose, went to the couch, and lay on it. Ah, it felt so good to relax. She shut her eyes, and that felt even better. Shortly, she fell asleep, with her ankles crossed on the armrest. Maddox looked up, staring at the lieutenant. He had seen the fear on her face. He'd also seen it drain away as she stared at him. With the peacefulness, her exhaustion had leapt up and grabbed her. He'd wanted to speak to her, but he divined that her need to sleep while she was able was more important. Maddox watched her, and his lips stretched into a rare smile. He lay back against his chair, stretching his legs under the table. It felt good to relax. It felt good to know that his presence helped put Valerie at ease. The others fed off his confidence. He could feel it draining him, but that was okay. The smile slipped away and a scowl touched his youthful features. What are we going to do? Is it possible to find Ludendorff among 550 million times Earth's area? In truth, a man could spend the rest of his life down there trying to do just that. Maddox held his pose, thinking deeply, realizing Victory and its crew might be in the most impossible situation of their rather short career. Chapter 31. Admiral Fletcher sat in his ready room looking at hollow image after hollow image of Hades IV, an Earth-like planet in the Hades system. After atmospheric recon units had determined that nothing moved on the planet, the landing parties had gone down. They had swept through various communities, recording everything. As Fletcher tapped holographic controls, he viewed empty homes with beds, tables, counters, tablets, all covered with dust. It was the same in the business establishments. It was clear the cities had been empty for some time. Fletcher stood. With a wave of his hand, he turned off the hollow images. First, cracking his knuckles, he strode to a display case of old-fashioned airplanes. Building them was a hobby of his. He had a Brazilian zipper from World War III, a Russian MiG-29, a British Spitfire, and the Red Baron's Fokker DR-1 triplane from World War I. He'd won an award with the DR-1 in high school, having to recite Baron von Richthofen's history before a panel of judges. That would have been something, flying by sight and stick, with the wind whipping in your hair. Men must have been tougher back then, having to line up the machine guns with your naked eye, watching red tracers zip through the sky. That would have been the era to be alive. It was so different these days, flying through space in perfectly comfortable starships. The admiral swiped a protein bar sitting on the display case. He unwrapped it and ate methodically, staring at the fighters from bygone times. Wiping his hands on his uniform, something that would have driven his mother wild, he turned back to his desk. "Give me C Quadrant, Section 2," he said. A star map with the Lahmer points glowing appeared in the air. The bulk of the Star Watch's ships were with him in the Hades system. Third Admiral Bishop was a jump away in the Hermes system with the Windsor League vessels. The rest of the fleet was a jump from Bishop in the Diana system. They had come a long way, apparently driving the new men before them, who kept their main fleet out of sight. All the while, though, the enemy had whittled away at them. Once, a handful of new men using traitorous humans as a lure had captured a hammer ship. Later, the hammer ship had lured Commodore Garcia to her death, losing precious battleships in the process. Those hidden mines were a frightening new development. Did the enemy have a limited supply of them? Why had they only used them there? After the mines, the most amazing development had been the hammer ship showing up in the new Venezuela system. How had it slipped all the way around, past the various patrols, without anyone sighting it? It showed the enemy could dance around them at will. Fletcher scratched his left cheek. The enemy had tried to trick them at New Venezuela into believing the hammer ship was reinforcements. Luckily, the traitorous humans helping the new men had regrown a conscience at the last minute. Even so, it had been a bitter fight. The Star Watch commander had destroyed the hammer ship, but at heavy cost. Clearly, the new men practiced deceit wherever they could. Each of their moves had begun with a trick. The deceit gave them an incredible force multiplier each time. Yes, the fakes before each attack seemed to be their signature style. In fact, it fit with their maneuvers against him in Korea 323 2 years ago. During the present campaign, the enemy had made two mistakes, one of them more an accident than an error. The first mistake had been the space bombardment against the empty cities on New Venezuela 3. It seemed like a nonsensical move. Once word of the planetary bombardment had spread to the Grand Fleet, it had hardened everyone's resolve. It had been the senselessness of the act, showing the enemy destroyed for no appreciable reason. It showed this was a fight to the death. The second error had been in the Remus system. Several star cruisers had struck like lightning there. They had pounced upon Sub-Commander Ko's forces, which had been stiffened with hammer ships. The hammer ships had lagged behind, though. At the end of the engagement, they'd accelerated and driven off the star cruisers, although at a cost. The new men had fought savagely before cunningly slipping away through an unstable Lommer point. The error had been an accident of battle, but it had changed so much for Fletcher. So very much. The Admiral almost smiled thinking about it, but he refused to permit himself such a luxury. Good men and women had died in the ambush, Windsor League and Social Syndicate people. The battle had cost them two hammer ships and four Social Syndicate cruisers. Even more importantly, Sub-Commander Ko had died. In his place had risen Sub-Commander Sos, a woman of dignity and reason. For reasons Fletcher still hadn't fathomed, Sub-Commander Sos had switched Social Syndicate policy, siding with him at the next meeting instead of Third Admiral Bishop as Ko had done. That had been a decisive moment in the campaign. From that time on, he'd gained popularity instead of seeing it dwindle. These days, Bishop plotted in secret instead of aloud at the meetings. Bishop studied Section 2 of C Quadrant. They were nearing a critical star system named Thebes. If the new men let Thebes 3 fall to the Grand Fleet... Fletcher shook his head in a silent quandary. Could the new men have fewer star cruisers left than anyone suspected? He had begun to believe in the possibility. The other side of him realized the possibility could be a gigantic lure. Maybe the new men wanted him to believe that, hoping to cause him to become reckless. The Admiral's nostrils flared. He'd studied military history as a cadet. Fletcher saw the new men as Hannibal of Carthage, a magician of battle, able to perform combat miracles. The Romans had waged bloody war year after year against the Punic magician, slowly wearing down the genius. In the end, the Romans had produced a genius of their own, taking the fight to the city of Carthage, beating Hannibal on the field of Zama. Fletcher dared to desire to emulate Scipio Africanus, the battlefield master of Hannibal Barca. The idea of people regarding him as the conqueror of the new men filled Fletcher with the resolve to try. I must use the enemy's maneuvers against him. Yes, he had to fight the new men on his terms, not theirs. Could Lord High Admiral have known he would feel this way? Fletcher couldn't see how. Still, he appreciated Cook's confidence in him those many months ago. Somewhere, Fletcher wanted to repay the Lord High Admiral for that confidence, for giving him his life back. The comm unit beeped on his desk. Admiral Fletcher here, he said, voice activating it. Sir, the comm officer said, a landing party has found a survivor. With immediate excitement, Fletcher activated the holo image display, putting the comm officer up. What did you say? He asked. Lieutenant Bergstrom, from Excalibur's A-Force, found a delirious man asleep in a bunker. He didn't make much sense, groaning more than talking. The lieutenant put him on a shuttle and routed it to Excalibur. The psychologists are preparing for him.
I want an hourly update, Fletcher said. Remind the psychologists I want to know what happened. Where did everyone go?
Yes, sir.
And this Lieutenant Bergstrom. Tell my coordinator she's up for an admiral's recommendation.
Will do, sir.
Did Bergstrom find anything else?
That was it, sir.
Fletcher out, he said as he closed down the comm. Yes, he said afterward. It looked like they were finally going to get some answers to this mystery. Several hours later, Excalibur's doctors still couldn't tell Fletcher anything. The man was badly malnourished and raving, almost out of his mind. Once, he had grabbed a doctor's arm, telling the man to run for the forest. The admiral shook his head as if shaking away those thoughts. He would have his answer soon enough, he hoped. Ever since Bergstrom found the survivor, Fletcher had begun to feel uneasy. Was the survivor another lure to a trap? The admiral drummed his fingers on his desk in the ready room. Was he becoming too paranoid? How could the new men have set that one up? He glanced at the tablet papers spread before him. The Grand Fleet possessed an impressive number of vessels, more than any human fleet in history. There were also many different kinds of spaceships, each better at one form of fighting than another. There were the 20 Windsor League hammer ships left. Each was worth 2 Star Watch battleships at close range. Together with their supply ships, that gave the Windsor League the greatest tonnage of vessels, along with considerable political influence at the conference table. The Wahhabi Sheikh Superior had brought 15 Scimitar-class warships, a type of craft between a Star Watch battleship and a heavy cruiser. Those ships had the best heavy-mount lasers in the Grand Fleet. They were also the best at long-ranged beam combat. Fletcher wished he had more of those. The respectable Kim Sung commanded 12 super junks, each the equivalent of a large Star Watch carrier. The respectable Kim also had 20 strike cruisers and a host of destroyers. The Qin Confederation had put up many warships fast. They must have been preparing for something like this for some time. Subcommander Sos of the Social Syndicate had 7 cruisers left and 11 destroyers. She had the largest number of vessels from a single system political entity. Adding in others from semi-independent systems gave another 3 battleships, 10 heavy cruisers, 12 strike cruisers, and 43 destroyer-sized vessels. The final component of the Grand Fleet belonged to Star Watch. Fletcher commanded the mightiest gathering of ships to date, many of them having come from the home fleet. By scraping together the remaining Star Watch forces into one giant mass, Fletcher commanded 18 battleships, 15 carriers, and 35 cruisers of various classes. It had been bigger at the beginning, but losses here and there had continued to mount. In all, the Grand Fleet boasted 167 capital ships, with masses of lesser vessels, so he almost had 400 combat ships. A vast force. Perhaps as important, the majority of the Star Watch ships had advanced harmonics shielding, while plenty of the vessels carried the new antimatter missiles. And there were the experimental jump fighters in 3 of the carriers. At the beginning of the Battle of Korea 323, the new men had faced him with 48 Star Cruisers. If they had 48 now, which he doubted, would they dare face the combat might of the Grand Fleet? Have we misjudged the new men's strength? That would be a galling thing. Yet that didn't seem right. The new men could have waited longer before launching their initial invasion. No one had known about them until they suddenly appeared out of the beyond. If all the enemy ships had cloaking like Strand's Star Cruiser, that would be a different story. But as far as Fletcher knew, the other Star Cruisers could not cloak like that. A blare of noise startled Fletcher. He whirled around. It was a red alert. The big man strode to the hatch, entering flagship Antietam's bridge. There was a flurry of activity as aides crisscrossed the bridge and executive officers ran scans and analyses. "Admiral on the bridge," a Marine said loudly. Fletcher went to his command chair, sitting erectly, watching his people. They moved smoothly and efficiently. They had purpose, and,
"Admiral,"
the sensor officer said,
"we have incoming data."
"Give it to me on the holo image, please," Fletcher said. The sensor officer nodded, manipulating her board. The Lommer point at a 3x Jupiter mass gas giant glowed with energy. Another star cruiser came through. There were already 3 in the Hades system. The tram line the new men were using meant the enemy had come in behind the Grand Fleet. This was like the new Venezuela hammer ship attack in that regard. Fletcher had been expecting something tricky like this. "Let's start counting," he said softly. The sensor officer did just that, along with probably everyone else. The new men hadn't shown themselves so openly yet. This was a new development.
"They're pouring out," the weapons officer said. "This could be their main fleet."
"Maybe," Fletcher said. The officer raised his eyebrows in astonishment at the admiral's comment. "The new men have used decoy forces before," Fletcher said. "I wouldn't be surprised if they were using them again here." It seemed as if a half hour passed in a blink. Sensors had counted 23 star cruisers so far. The main Star Watch fleet in the Hades system was halfway between the Earth-like planet and the massive Jovian giant out there. 500,000 kilometers separated them from the enemy-held wormhole. Soon, sensors counted an amazing 54 star cruisers. Along with everyone else, Fletcher watched the enemy vessels gather. A growing certainty had taken hold in him. Every new men assault this campaign had begun with a trick. He knew that. Now he had to muster the courage to act upon his knowledge. But it was so hard. If he was wrong about this, the stakes meant defeat could bring total victory to the remorseless new men. Fletcher warred with his heart. He wavered, almost decided, and then flinched from committing himself. Sweat beaded under his collar. His palms felt moist, and his breaths became harder to take. Suddenly, as he suppressed a groan, Fletcher pounded the arm of his command chair.
"We're heading for them," he said. "Pass the message to the other ships."
The captain of Antietam turned around.
"Begging your pardon, Admiral?" she said.
"I don't want to hear it," Fletcher snapped. He took a long breath, the first one like this for a while. "Get that order out now," he told communications. "I also want a courier ship leaving for Bishop. Tell the Third Admiral to hurry here. We finally have our fight. I want to hit the new men while I have a chance."
The bridge crew stared at him.
"Now,"
Fletcher said, pounding the arm of his chair again. In a subdued manner, the flagship's bridge crew went about their tasks. Soon, Star Watch's battleships, carriers, cruisers, and masses of destroyers and escort vessels began accelerating toward the 500 million kilometer distant Lommer Point and the largest enemy fleet to date.
"I'm counting 62 star cruisers," the sensor officer said, "and I think more are still coming through."
"Good," Fletcher said.
The captain of Antietam had become pale.
"Admiral, 62 star cruisers? We didn't think they had that many. Now we're going to face them all by ourselves?"
Fletcher stared at her. Why was this so difficult to say? He knew the truth. With an effort of will, he forced out the words.
"Those aren't real star cruisers, Captain. You're viewing decoy ships."
Several of the crew glanced at each other.
How do you know that, sir?"
the captain asked.
"Because I know the new men's methods," Fletcher said. "So do you. We've discussed it often enough."
"But, sir, isn't that the point? No one can outwit them. The new men are always 3 steps ahead of us."
"Not this time," Fletcher said.
"How can you be so certain, sir?"
Fletcher eyed the captain, a good commander, willing to take reasonable risks. But this didn't seem reasonable to her. Star Watch had a few more capital ships in the Hades system than the number of star cruisers. By the calculations of battle as previously fought, they didn't stand a chance against 62 star cruisers.
"I want maximum acceleration," Fletcher said.
"Admiral,"
the captain said,
"I don't mean any disrespect by this, but I think you should call a commander's meeting. The others are going to balk at this. The 62 star cruisers have begun accelerating away from the Lommer Point," Sensor said.
"What is their direction?" Fletcher asked. Sensors found it difficult to speak.
They're on an intercept course for us, sir, heading straight for our fleet.
Chapter 32 Fletcher had the meeting, as there'd likely be a mutiny if he didn't. After the fleet had accelerated at the Star Cruisers for a time, they paused as shuttles ferried the many commanders to the Antietam. Soon, Fletcher stood outside the hatch. He thrust his shoulders back and strode into the conference chamber. It was crammed with commanders and their chief executives. For many, it was standing room only as they stood shoulder to shoulder against the walls. Ventilation worked overtime as a sour smell of sweat hung in the air. Fletcher knew the smell. People were scared, afraid that tomorrow they would die under a hail of fusion beams. He didn't blame them. A knot of fear twisted in his own belly. He simply chose to ignore it, as he knew he could not trust it. Fletcher walked to the front of the long table. Anxious faces peered up at him. A few looked angry. Clearly, no one understood why the fleet raced at an incredible number of star cruisers, the most dangerous warships in the galaxy. They all believed they should wait for Bishop and the Chin Confederation warships.
"Good day, gentlemen, gentlewomen," Fletcher said with a nod. "I'm glad you could join me for this historic occasion."
He scanned the throng. They were his men and women. The Lord High Admiral had trusted him to lead them in order to save the Commonwealth, to save regular humanity when one came right down to it. Today he had to win them to his plan. He had already decided on the best means for doing that.
"This is a historic occasion," Fletcher said, "as the new men have finally made a mistake."
Officers blinked at him, some of their fear turning into confusion.
"You're the best Star Watch has," Fletcher said. "I know, because the Lord High Admiral handpicked you for the assignment. We're to drive the golden-skinned invaders out of C Quadrant. Until this moment, the enemy has retreated from us out of fear, burning some planets and no doubt taking the people off others. Well, we're going to find out why in the next day or so."
"Admiral," said Commodore Harold, commander of a task force of the newest battleships, "I don't understand your thinking, sir. We're accelerating towards 62 star cruisers. We'll be fighting the new men at a numerical parity. Since they have vastly superior equipment, they will decimate us."
"That's just it," Fletcher said. "There aren't 62 star cruisers. They're using decoys today, trying to bluff us."
"That isn't what the sensor readings are saying, sir."
"You're exactly right, Commodore," Fletcher said.
The Admiral smiled. He scanned those in the room. Could he trust these people? "If I can't, I'd better step down from command."
"I'll let you in on a secret," Fletcher said. "I do not know 100% if these are decoy ships or not, but everything I've seen and studied about the new men leads me to this conclusion."
"Do you care to tell us your reasoning, sir?" Harold asked.
"I would be delighted," Fletcher said. "The truth is, I can't do this unless you're all on board with me. We're a band of brothers facing the worst enemy the universe has thrown at us."
Fletcher inhaled, nodding.
"I faced the new men at Korea 323. There, the enemy suckered me. I lost many good ships because of it. I learned then that the new men are masters of deception. They used decoy forces to draw me out of a fortified position. Today, I believe they are attempting to get us to use the Lommer Point to flee there. But I've asked myself a question," Fletcher said. "If the new men appear in strength like this, isn't my only logical choice to cut and run?"
"That's exactly what I think," Harold said.
"And I did too at first. Then I realized the new men would know that about us. That meant the enemy was trying to herd us in a particular direction. They would do so in order to spring a trap on the fleet. To escape the trap, I should do the exact opposite of what they're trying to get me to do. Realizing that, it dawned on me that the 62 star cruisers are decoys, or most of them must be."
Many present appeared thoughtful.
"I think I understand, sir," Harold said. "But what if the new men have accounted for it?
Maybe they believe you'll think they're bluffing. In that way, they can cause us to race toward our destruction.
Fletcher shook his head. Every move of theirs this campaign has begun with a ruse.
You said they miscalculated.
I did, Fletcher said. I suspect that a few real Star Cruisers are hidden among the decoys. They need a few to fire some fusion beams to make everything seem legitimate. I wish to annihilate those vessels. The new men can't afford any losses, and that's what we're going to give them. This time, we're going to whittle their numbers down.
This is a gamble, sir.
I've told you my reasoning, Fletcher said. Remember, the new men aren't gods. They're just good. We can outmaneuver them sometimes. But if we're going to head against 62 decoys or so, I need my people understanding why we're doing it. The Admiral nodded at them before saying, Now, let me hear what you think. No one spoke in the sudden silence. Finally, Commodore Harold cleared his throat.
I like your reasoning, sir. They're trying to frighten us. They want us to run. That means we should do the opposite, yes. Let's attack.
Right, a woman said. I agree.
Others said likewise.
Does anyone disagree? Fletcher said.
No one did, verbally.
Excellent, Fletcher said, beaming at his people. Now he knew he could trust them.
Then let's get back to our ships and continue to accelerate. 36 hours brought many changes to the equation. The majority of the 62 Star Cruisers continued to bear down on the Star Watch fleet. Two Star Cruisers had veered away at a sharp angle, accelerating hard for a different Lommer point. The Admiral had ordered a change of heading for the entire fleet. They chased the two Star Cruisers, trying to bring them in range of the battleship's heaviest long-ranged beams. Meanwhile, reports from the Hermes-Hades tramline brought bad news. Three hammer ships had sustained grave damage from invisible mines near their wormhole entrance. Fortunately, Third Admiral Bishop had let his hammer ships accelerate in a staggered formation. Thus, instead of many of the Windsor League warships taking damage, it was a mere three. Fletcher sent a communique among his ships, telling his officers that those hidden mines had been for the Star Watch ships that would have been in the grip of jump lag. They might have lost half the Star Watch fleet if they had fled from the supposed 62 Star Cruisers. The hours grinded away as the fleet chased the two Star Cruisers. Ever so slowly, the fastest cruisers gained on the enemy.
Sir,
the sensor officer said. Fletcher sat in his command chair. Go ahead, Major, he said.
Look at the ghost fleet, sir.
Fletcher smiled grimly as the images betrayed themselves. He had been right about the decoy forces. Not until this moment, however, did the knot in his gut go away. 90 minutes later, the running battle entered its most interesting phase. Fletcher ordered a massive salvo of missiles. He did not use antimatter missiles, as he wanted to hold on to those for the big one. Instead, several flocks of conventional missiles accelerated at 50 gravities for the two Star Cruisers. The missiles gained velocity hand over fist against the new men.
The heavy cruisers are in beam range, sir, the sensor officer said.
I'm going to talk to the enemy, Fletcher told Comm.
Soon, Admiral Fletcher called on the new men to surrender. They did not answer. He kept trying, and they kept ignoring him.
We gave them a chance, Fletcher said. Now, we finish them.
The battle was anticlimactic, as Star Watch vastly outgunned the two lone Star Cruisers. The missiles zoomed in, and the new men used auto-defense fire and their famed fusion beams. It was a steady progression of missile destruction. Finally, though, one of the missiles got close enough to detonate. The thermonuclear pulse must have hurt the enemy's sensors. Soon, a second and third missile ignited even closer than the first one.
Hit, sir, sensors said. One of the Star Cruiser's engines is running too hot.
Fletcher felt as if he was part of a pack running down rabid wolves. He liked the feeling and was sure everyone else did as well. Heavy cruisers pounded the new men vessels with beams. The enemy shields absorbed that for a time. The shields went through the regular hues, finally reaching black.
Open channels again, Fletcher said. He offered the new men a last chance to surrender. They did not say a word in reply. Finally, the first Star Cruiser went critical, exploding in a Nova blast. Antietam's bridge erupted into cheers. Fletcher smiled indulgently. He could actually do it. He could outthink the enemy. It was a wonderful feeling. He would gladly trade 3 hammer ships for 2 Star Cruisers. The enemy could not afford such attrition. The Grand Fleet could. The last Star Cruiser ejected a pod. Fletcher noticed that and had the pod marked. "We'll pick up the occupant later. First, finish the last Star Cruiser." It took 8 more minutes. Then, that vessel went Nova as well. Fletcher sat back. He'd done it. He'd destroyed 2 Star Cruisers. The new men would have 2 less when the fleets finally engaged. He turned to sensors. "What are the readings concerning the life pod?"
"There's a single survivor, sir," sensors said. "The readings indicate a new man."
"Open channels with the pod," Fletcher said.
"They're open, sir," Comm said.
"This is Admiral Fletcher hailing the escape pod." The main screen wavered and a battered new man stared at them. He had haughty golden features and a buzz cut of hair. "Do you surrender?" Fletcher asked.
"I am 5th rank, Pa Kerr," the new man said. "And I request asylum with Star Watch."
"Say again?" Fletcher said, not sure he'd heard right.
"I am a political refugee," the new man said, "and I request political asylum with the Commonwealth."
"That's a new one," Fletcher muttered. "Very well," he told Pa Kerr. "We accept your surrender. I will send a shuttle to pick you up."
"I am not surrendering," the new man said. "I repeat, I request asylum."
"Right," Fletcher said. "We're picking you up." He motioned to Comm, and she cut the connection.
"What do you make of that, sir?"
Antietam's captain asked. "I'm not sure," Fletcher said. "I suppose I'll find out during interrogation." Chapter 33. Before Fletcher had the pleasure of watching the interrogation of this 5th-ranked Pa Kerr, Excalibur's intelligence chief wished to speak with him. It would be via a laser light guide link. The carrier was still in orbit around Hades IV. Antietam headed toward the Lommer point linking this system to the Hermes system. The majority of the fleet did likewise. Fletcher sat in the conference chamber with several other officers. This was concerning the lone survivor in the bunker on Hades IV. It seemed the man had finally begun to talk coherently. "Open channels," Fletcher said. A hollow image appeared in the center of the room. It showed Commander Rainey Fells, a 60-year-old woman in Star Watch intelligence. She had eagle-like features and a manner of staring as if watching a tasty mouse cross a field.
"Good day, Admiral," she said.
Fletcher made the introductions, finding it was a good link with minimal delay. "We're all very interested," Fletcher told her. "What has the survivor said?" The intelligence officer cleared her throat.
"His station is Service Tech 3. His name is Monsieur George Dunbar, age 38. He worked on a dam, on the turbine specifically. He happened to be on vacation at the time in the wilds. His chief hobby is botany, which makes little sense given his occupation. He had hiked to a lonely valley thick with vegetation. Monsieur Dunbar believes that's why the new men's scanners missed him. He was good at living in the wild, a bit of a survivalist, I believe."
Fletcher nodded, absorbed with the information.
"He was coherent while explaining all that," Commander Fells said. "But once we spoke to him about the new men, he began to stammer and rave. I'm not sure how much faith I would place in his explanation. The doctors assure me this could all be a hallucination. The truth could be many times worse."
"What did he say?" Fletcher asked. The intelligence officer checked her tablet.
"Monsieur Dunbar spoke about a construction project. The new men built, he called them, chambers. Each one sucked up tremendous levels of energy. He snuck back to his dam once, watching the power drain when they turned them on."
"Turned what on?" Fletcher asked.
The chambers, sir,
the intelligence officer said.
Monsieur Dunbar claimed the new men stuffed each one to capacity. He was quite emphatic about one particular. They only put women in or men in, never a mixture.
Go on, Fletcher said, his stomach beginning to churn with uneasiness.
People went in, according to Monsieur Dunbar, but they never came out.
They were annihilation chambers? Fletcher asked in horror.
That's my assessment, sir, the intelligence officer said briskly. The new men have practiced genocide elsewhere. Why not here on Hades IV as well?
Monsieur Dunbar agrees with your assessment, Fletcher asked.
Most emphatically not, sir, the officer said. He said a ghostly beam appeared from the chamber reaching up into space. He suggests, well, a teleportation device.
What?
I know that's preposterous, the officer said. Dunbar claimed that's why the new men packed women into one and men into another.
Why?
Because the new men sent the women to one place and the men to somewhere different,
Commander Fells said. Where does Dunbar think the new men teleported these people?
He has several theories, the sanest being into waiting cargo haulers in orbit.
And the most insane theory? Fletcher asked.
To another planet in another star system, she said.
If that's true, why haven't the new men used the teleporting device as a military weapon?
Precisely,
Fells said. Fletcher glanced at his people. Any questions? He asked them. They had none. Do you have anything else to report? Fletcher asked Fells.
Not yet, she said. We're still trying various treatments. He's raving now, completely incoherent. We're hoping to restore his sanity as quickly as possible.
Thank you for your report, Fletcher said. After the hollow image winked out, the Admiral's intelligence chief spoke up. If the new men have teleportation capabilities, Fletcher shook his head, they would have used such a power by now. What if it's a new technology? The man asked. It was used at least a year ago, Fletcher said, possibly longer. That means the enemy has possessed it for some time, if Monsieur Dunbar is telling the truth.
Do you doubt him?
The psychologist asked. Fletcher pursed his lips. No. He saw something. I'm willing to bet it seared his thinking.
I agree, the psychologist said. This is likely the source of his psychosis. The new men set up chambers where women went in and a ghostly column appeared that reached into space. I doubt it was a death chamber. They could have easily dropped hellburners from orbit if they wanted to kill everyone.
Are they searching for something among the people?
Possibly, the doctor said.
Or maybe they're using the people for a project.
What kind of project? Fletcher asked. The doctor examined his fingernails before saying,
I've been wondering about that for some time, Admiral. I imagined when the new men stand and fight, and if we win, we'll finally discover our answer.
On that note, Fletcher dismissed them. Here was another piece of the puzzle. Maybe the new man asking for asylum had some answers.
Chapter 34. Pa Kerr endured the questions, the medical probing, and the x-rays to his head. He even let the submen touch him without going into a berserk fury and slaughtering them with his bare hands. He had asked for asylum, but they believed he had surrendered. It was a galling state of affairs. They had no idea he had escaped from the Star Cruiser. He had escaped the service of the hateful Strand. Strand had put him under a machine. The Methuselah man had used him, programmed his mind. That was a frightful injustice. Strand had acted upon a superior as he would act upon weak submen. Pa Kerr knew that Strand secretly laughed at him. As he waited in this cell, Pa Kerr shivered with suppressed rage. The Emperor had been right after all. The new men must not trust Strand. They must make their own way in the universe, achieving more and climbing higher than their genetic predecessors, Homo sapien man.
It was a mistake invading human space. We should have traveled in the other direction, launching even deeper into the beyond.
Homo sapiens always marred whatever they touched. Pa Kerr wondered if that meant they had already marred him. The hatch abruptly slid up. Pa Kerr tensed internally, although he hadn't let a single muscle twitch.
"Stand, you," a Marine captain growled. "We're taking you to another chamber."
Pa Kerr turned his head on the pillow. The Marine wore space armor, aiming a heavy caliber gun at him. Behind the human were other Marines in combat armor. The submen were not taking any chances with him. He did not blame them, although he hated these subhuman creatures.
"Do you want us to manhandle you?" the captain asked.
Without a word, Pa Kerr stood and headed for the hatch. He walked erectly, proudly, knowing that he was superior to everyone in the submen fleet. What he did not understand was how the lower order had found the courage to attack an apparent 62 star cruisers. Pa Kerr had toyed with the idea that one of the commanding submen had figured out the deception ahead of time. Yet, try as he might, he found the hypothesis impossible to accept. The Marines marched him through ship corridors, bringing him to a new chamber. It had armored bulkheads. Even without weapons, they feared him. How truly weak these submen were. There was a table in the middle of the room. A man already sat in one of the chairs. Pa Kerr entered with the armored Marines. He sat on the other chair while they lined the walls, five armored killers with weapons. As he placed his golden-colored hands on the table, Pa Kerr noticed one-way glass. Important people would be watching today. He wondered who stood behind the one-way glass.
"Fifth rank, Pa Kerr," the man at the table began.
Pa Kerr focused on the specimen. He was short and stocky, but possessed a large brain case. This one might have a modicum of intelligence.
"You claim a desire for asylum," the stocky man said.
"Yes,"
Pa Kerr answered.
"Are you repudiating your citizenship to the throne world?"
Pa Kerr hesitated before saying,
"Yes."
"You wish to join the Commonwealth of Planets?"
"I do."
"That requires an exchange on your part. We can give you asylum, but it will cost you information about the throne world and the star cruisers."
Pa Kerr stared at the stocky fool. The subman tried to stare back into his eyes, but failed, looking down.
"We desire the throne world's coordinates," the man said.
Pa Kerr said nothing.
"If we do not grant you asylum, you will be considered a prisoner of war."
Pa Kerr continued to remain silent.
"Do you comprehend my words?" the man said.
"Yes."
"Then why don't you answer?"
"I cannot give you the throne world's coordinates, as I do not know them."
"That's a lie."
Pa Kerr stiffened. The desire to reach out and rip out the man's throat almost caused him to twitch. He must not do that, and yet he did not know why.
"You don't like me calling you a liar, do you?" the subman asked.
"I do not lie."
"Why did your two-star cruisers flee?"
Pa Kerr said nothing.
"Do you know the reason?" the man asked.
"I do not."
"That is another lie," the man said.
Pa Kerr's obsidian-colored eyes glinted with rage.
"If you attempt to harm me," the stocky man said, "these Marines will subdue you."
Pa Kerr said nothing.
"For a man who wants asylum, you are strangely reluctant to speak."
"You have not asked me a question I can answer."
"Why did the new man build chambers on Hades IV?
"Chambers?" asked Pa Kerr.
"Teleporting chambers?" the man asked.
Pa Kerr bent his head, staring at the table. A throb beat in his forebrain. It opened something in him. He looked up at the quizzical subman.
"Who desires this knowledge?"
Pa Kerr heard himself ask.
"I do."
"Who watches us?"
The stocky man glanced at the one-way glass. At that moment, it happened. It felt to Pa Kerr as if tumblers moved in his mind. He put his hands under the table and heaved as hard and as fast as he could. The table flipped against the stocky man, hurling him and his chair toward the Marines. Pa Kerr was up and moving as the table flew through the air. He had entered overdrive, realizing vaguely that Strand must have meant for the submen to capture him all along. Strand had outguessed the enemy commander. Pa Kerr had been the only new man on his Star Cruiser. Both vessels had run on automated systems. He realized these things as he reached the first Marine. The stocky man thudded against the bulkhead and the table splintered into many pieces due to the violence of its trajectory. Pa Kerr knew that his body would burn out. The muscles and tendons would tear under the intense strain. That did not matter today. He had a final purpose. Strand had seen to that. The Methuselah man had an opponent in the enemy fleet. Ripping the raised gun out of the Marine captain's armored grip, Pa Kerr turned the weapon on the subman, blowing out the faceplate. He dodged other bullets. The secret enablers wired into him allowed him to do so. In a matter of seconds, he destroyed all the Marines in the cell. Afterward, Pa Kerr raised the gun and fired at the one-way glass, shredding it. Star Watch officers shouted in horror, several of them ducking. One of them went down hard, with a shard of one-way glass sprouting from his eye. Pa Kerr's lips twitched into a smile. He raised his gun, aimed at a harsh-faced officer with Admiral Tabs on his shoulders, and squeezed the trigger. It clicked empty. Pa Kerr had used the final bullets to shatter the glass. No matter. The new man hurled the gun at an officer, aiming one at him. The thud dropped the officer. At that point, Pa Kerr launched himself through the broken frame. The Admiral did not flee, but snarled like an animal. They were all animals. Pa Kerr sailed at the Admiral, crashing against him, his iron strong fingers clutching the throat. A hard impact blew the air out of Pa Kerr's lungs. He knew without looking down that a force blade had entered him. The Admiral jerked the blade, twisting and sawing. Pa Kerr clutched harder. He must kill Admiral Fletcher. He must destroy the brains of the Grand Fleet. Pa Kerr's eyelids fluttered as life drained from his glorious body. As he slipped away, he wondered if he had killed the Admiral. He hoped. He hoped. Pa Kerr frowned. Had he attacked at Strand's will? I hope I failed. Pa Kerr thought. Then he died, hating Strand with his final breath.
Chapter 35. Victory neared the Dyson Sphere. The starship had been braking for some time. It was presently at a Luna-like distance from the monstrous spheroid surface. Captain Maddox sat at the command chair. He studied the main screen where Valerie had zoomed in on the Port Admiral's flotilla. The flagship was a Bismarck-class battleship, the Leipzig. Its sister battleship, the Vienna, was also part of the flotilla, which included three strike cruisers armed with antimatter missiles, five destroyers, two escorts, and three supply ships. High Command had believed the antimatter missiles gave Hayes the needed destructive power necessary to defeat any silver drones the Port Admiral might have found in the Xerxes system.
"Still no sign of damage to the ships?" Maddox asked.
"Negative," Galleon said, standing beside the command chair.
"Not a scratch on any of the hull armor?"
"Checking," the AI said. "Oh, please excuse my error. Yes, I detect more than scratches. There are strange buff marks. I have seen similar."
"Ah,
it should have been obvious. Captain, I detect the after effect of neutron beam shots."
"Neutron," Maddox said. "Did they cut through the hulls?"
"Negative."
"Then..."
"Captain, please allow me to complete my report."
Maddox nodded.
"I have seen one similarity to this, the neutron shots against Victory, that induced a thought loop in my AI core."
"So there's one mystery solved,"
Valerie said. Maddox turned to her.
"Explain your reasoning, Lieutenant."
"It seems simple enough, sir. The flotilla's computers went cold after the special neutron beam thought-looped all of them. With the computers offline, maybe the life support systems shut down. Maybe everybody over there is dead."
The last words came out higher pitched than the first.
"That's one possibility.
Maddox said in a calm voice. Until we know, though, let us not jump to conclusions. I hope to find the Port Admiral and his people quite alive. Until I have reason to know otherwise, that is our operating assumption. It took a second before Valerie said,
Yes, sir. I think that's the better assumption, too.
There was a moment of silence as that sank in.
What's next, sir?
Keith asked. Maddox slapped an armrest. Galleon, have you spotted any life anywhere?
Negative,
the hollow image said. Have you spotted any sensor devices attempting to scan us?
I would have immediately informed you of such an event, sir.
Maddox used the knuckles of his right hand to brush his cheek. I'm going to use a shuttle.
Sir,
Valerie said, as if she'd been waiting for him to say those words.
I don't think you should use a shuttle to go anywhere. Frankly, sir, we don't want to lose you.
Maddox studied the lieutenant.
What if Ludendorff is waiting for exactly that?
Valerie asked.
What if he uses a tractor beam on the shuttle and yanks you onto the Dyson sphere?
We must inspect the battleships, Maddox said. We must determine the crew's fates. That is our first priority.
Send a probe, sir, Valerie suggested. You're too valuable to risk.
Maddox considered that. While that is a noble sentiment,
I think everyone aboard Victory will agree with me, Valerie added, interrupting the captain.
Maddox noted the anxiety in her bearing. He glanced at the second lieutenant. The pilot's fingers drummed against his board too fast, nervously, it would appear. I see, Maddox said to himself. Mr. Maker, maneuver closer to the flotilla, please. We will come within several kilometers. Then I shall send a probe, as the lieutenant suggests. Out of the corner of his eye, Maddox saw that Valerie almost said thank you. Instead, she nodded to him and went back to her board. Maddox studied the main screen. What would the probe find once it reached the Leipzig? Were Hayes and his people dead? Or was there a different explanation to the mute vessels? Tension mounted on the bridge as Victory eased toward Leipzig, with only a few kilometers separating them. Beyond the flotilla's flagship loomed what now seemed like a wall of Dyson sphere, although the outer surface of the sphere was several thousand kilometers away. All stop, Maddox said. Keith tapped his board. Send the probe, Maddox said. Valerie manipulated her panel. On the main screen, a small object left the starship with hydrogen exhaust propelling it toward the battleship. The distance was minuscule and the probe's speed almost non-existent compared to normal starship velocities. The minutes ticked away.
Shall I increase magnification, sir?
Valerie asked. Please, the captain said. Instead of the battleship and Dyson sphere background, the Leipzig magnified into sight, with bigger laser cannons showing their orifices.
The hull armor looks clean,
Keith said. Maddox nodded in silent agreement.
I'm maneuvering the probe to a hangar entryway, Valerie said.
Several minutes later, as the lieutenant tapped quickly, the main battleship hatch began to open.
We know one thing, Valerie said. The Leipzig is still responding to code. That would indicate the main computer still works.
Maddox watched the probe maneuver into the lit hangar bay. It was smaller than Victory's bay, but full of strike fighters.
Are any missing? Maddox asked.
They appear to all be there, sir,
the lieutenant said, checking a manifest. Soon the probe landed on the deck.
Detaching a crawler, Valerie said.
A vehicle much like the ancient Mars Explorer dropped off the probe's hull and began to rove across the battleship's hangar bay. The lieutenant controlled it through radio signals, although it could make limited command decisions on its onboard computer. During the next half hour, Maddox, Keith, Valerie, and Galleon watched the probe crawl through the empty battleship. No one was aboard. However, the lieutenant was unable to find any evidence of combat or a struggle.
It appears as if they simply left the ship, sir, Valerie said later.
Let's get the ship's log, Maddox said.
In time, the crawler reached the battleship's bridge. It used a link tube connecting with the computer system.
Ready to transfer,
the lieutenant said.
I just had a thought, Galleon said. Transfer the data into a separate computer file here.
What are you thinking? Valerie asked.
Maybe a builder virus infected the battleship's computers. We do not want the virus to infect my systems.
Good thinking, Galleon, the lieutenant said. Give me a few minutes to set this up.
Time passed slowly as the others waited.
Okay, Valerie said. I'll begin the transfer.
She tapped her board, but nothing happened. She tried again with the same results.
Trouble? The captain asked.
Either the crawler isn't responding, or something in the battleship's computer is not responding.
The main screen suddenly wavered, shivered with fuzziness, and then Professor Ludendorff regarded them. At least the humanoid shape appeared to be the Methuselah man they had come to know.
Greetings, the professor said. I see you made it to the Dyson Sphere.
How did he cut into our comm stream? Maddox demanded.
Valerie manipulated her board, soon shaking her head.
This is from the battleship's main computer, sir. We're not in a direct comm link with him.
By now, the professor said, you must surely have begun to wonder about my intent. I can assure you that it is completely benign. Given Captain Maddox's temperament, though, I doubt you will believe me. I suspect you destroyed the Guardian ship. It was set to defeat any vessel but yours. I urge you not to worry about the Port Admiral and his people. They are fine. Captain, I would like you to join me inside the Dyson Sphere. There is something I must show you, and you alone. Please come down at once. Time is fast running out for all of us.
Until then,
the professor said. He bowed, smiled, and disappeared from the screen.
This is interesting indeed, Galleon said. It appears the professor has been expecting us.
Lieutenant, Maddox said, I want more information. Bring up the rest of the data in the Leipzig's computer.
Valerie manipulated her board, trying harder, and soon shaking her head.
I'm sorry, sir. I can't download anything else. There's a firewall in place I can't breach.
Galleon, Maddox said, break down the firewall.
At once, Captain, the AI said.
After several minutes, the hollow image stirred.
I cannot break the firewall, Captain. This is most disturbing. I will—
Just a moment, Maddox said, who had been thinking.
Maybe that's the game. The professor wants Galleon to dig deeper. In some manner, Ludendorff will spring a computer trap attempting a takeover. Galleon, exit the probe.
It is done, the hollow image said. What do we do now?
Valerie asked.
It seems we're stymied.
Sir, Keith said. It's the Dyson Sphere. A door is opening on its surface.
What do you think that means?
Battle stations, Maddox said. Galleon, ready the disruptor cannon. Lieutenant, make sure the shield is fully charged. Mr. Maker, begin backing away. I want you to warn the others in the ship we might have to make some violent maneuvers.
Aye, aye, sir,
Keith said.
As the others went about their tasks, Maddox watched the giant hatch. It had to be 10 times the size of Victory. Soon, a vast metal object with a huge orifice eased out of the opening. Was that like the destroyer's main weapon?
What is that? Keith asked.
I don't think it's aiming at us.
I do not detect any tracking systems fixed upon us, Galleon said. That would not preclude optical sighting, however. Will it launch missiles?
Sir,
Valerie said, there are more of those metal objects. They've appeared all over the surface of the sphere.
A bad feeling swept over Maddox. He leaned forward, rubbing the fingers of his right hand. The orifice near them glowed orange.
The shield is at full strength, Valerie said.
I'm maneuvering behind the Leipzig, sir, Keith said.
As the orifice grew hotter orange, a blue line appeared. The blueness grew larger and brighter. The same happened elsewhere with the other squat cannons.
Exhaust, Valerie said. Those are exhaust tails.
You're kidding, Keith said.
Valerie tapped her board, studying the readings.
That's an ion exhaust. The sphere isn't firing at us. It's moving.
She turned to look questioningly at Maddox.
Is the sphere a spaceship? Keith asked.
That is entirely the wrong conclusion, Galleon said. I have been running calculations. The Dyson Sphere's physics suggests the answer.
What's that mean in English? Keith asked.
Galleon stared at the Scotsman.
Elaborate on your answer, Maddox told the AI.
It is elementary and fundamental, Galleon said.
Adok scientists had long projected such a construct as we're now seeing. I have listened to the lieutenant suggest an inhabitable area 550 million times that of Earth. She has not taken into account some of the major problems concerning the sphere. If you're so smart, Valerie said, why don't you enlighten us?
Gladly, Galleon said. The propulsion we are witnessing addresses one of the problems. The sphere, or shell, lacks a net gravitational interaction with its englobed star. Therefore, the shell drifts in relation to the interior object. Given enough time, the sphere will collide into the massive energy unit. These propulsion systems must be engaged in a corrective endeavor.
That makes sense, Valerie said. I'm surprised I missed it.
Notice the rotation of the sphere, Galleon continued. If it lacked rotation, the inside of the shell would have zero artificial gravity. Everything in the interior surface would thus fall into the star. Given the rotation, the artificial gravity, the contents of the interior surface will pool around the equator. In your parlance, the sphere is acting like a Niven ring for habitation purposes.
Why go to all that trouble to build a global shell then? Keith asked.
Once more, the answer is elementary, Galleon said. It is to collect the star's energy output. I have made a simple calculation. Given a soul-like star, that is 384.6 yottawatts of power.